Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Hello, World Service members and Monday only listeners. A belated happy St. Patrick's Day to you all, and welcome to your Bank Holiday Monday Second Captain's Podcast. Hi, Murph. Hi, Ken.
Hello there, Owen.
How are you?
I'm okay. You would have been proud of me on Saturday, Murph. Delivered a real life.
I'm always proud of you. Owen, stop now. Just before we begin, I'm always proud of you. Why would I be particularly proud of you?
I delivered a real life McTepa take during the England Scotland game.
Oh, I've heard a couple of those as well. Carry on.
Not so much a McTepa take, more just an awful take, right? So I was watching the match.
See, the McTepa take has to be like, you have to kind of agree with it, but be bored by it at the same time.
Yeah. No, this is just pretty serious. So in my defense, we had just watched the horror show in Cardiff. I'd had a few drinks. Perhaps that drink was having a somewhat depressive effect. I don't know, apparently it can have that effect as well as, you know, making you feel all bulletproof and all that kind of stuff. Mm. So I was just getting pissy and moany, basically.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Watching England go to town on the poor Scots the first half, just talking smack about Scotland. A bit like you tend to do, you know, something about how rubbish they are. Every year we hear about how they're going to challenge for the Six Nations. They never do.
Yeah, they're a disgrace.
Yeah. I was McTepa taking my friends, essentially.
Yeah.
But what about Finn Russell? One of my friend pipes up bravely during this rant.
Oh, yeah. Turned the cannon on him, did you?
Finn Russell. I said, Finn Russell is shite.
Yeah.
That's what I said. I knew this was not a great take immediately. I mean, he's quite a good player. But I didn't think there was any danger that he was going to prove me so wrong
in that group in of that friends. Game. Yeah, probably. Like, I mean, you were going to be able to get out of the house, from this social occasion without having
I was expecting maybe a text from my friend 6 months later after an amazing performance or whatever it might be during the World
He's
Cup.
He's torn it up in the second round
of
the Champions
League. God, I had to watch it back again yesterday with a clear head to confirm just how incredible Finn Russell was. He had that lovely little short pass for one of the tries while giving the eyes as though he was going to whip it out long. Don't know if you remember that one. The beautiful skip pass for another, which he's just incredible at. He scores an intercept try himself, not for the first time this Six Nations. Manages to rip the ball from the hands of an England prop towards the end with the game in the balance. And it's, I don't know if he saw this. He essentially ripped the ball from, I think it was Genge's hands, and delivered it to his inside centre all in one motion. Now, you could say that the fact that it landed in the hands of his inside centre was
A happy accident.
I'm not sure. The way he was playing, it might have been a deliberate motion. There was a beautiful kick to touch in the really dying minutes that should have been enough to kill the game for the Scots. All of that stuff. Then he does his post-match interview, and he's asked, so what happened in the second half? And he said, well, I just told Gregor, like, we're doing this all wrong. I mean, you're telling us to kick over there. It's just not working. So we changed. So essentially, he delivered the game plan for the second half. And I know I'm making him sound a little bit cocky there. Even the way he delivered those lines was quite charming. He's a really nice guy, Finn Russell. So fair to say, I felt chastened by full time. Very chastened.
Now we talk about what I want to talk about. Let's go, champ. Let's go, champ.
This is the most tepid McTepa take.
Yeah, it's the champ.
Just protocol, sir, Owen.
Well, no, I played that for my mates before getting on into my take.
Someone quick, pause the television. McDevitt's woken up and he's got something to say.
I wasn't quite... he looks angry. I wasn't quite as chastened as the Irish team, who would have been Six Nations champions, Ken. if they'd done their bit. We asked last week which of the Scots would step up and give us our Gary Mackay moment. Mm-hmm. Well, there were a team of Gary Mackays in the second half. Finn Russell, Darcy Graham, Sam Johnson, and on Scottish Lionhearts left, right and centre. But unfortunately, things didn't go to plan in Cardiff. Narrow defeat for our boys.
Yeah.
We lost a squeaker in the end.
Real squeaker, yeah.
It was a bit worrying, right?
I mean, please, speak honestly. Well, what did you make of it all?
I was left with a lot of questions about the character of the team.
What sort of questions?
Is there a bit too much Instagram influencing going on? A bit too much celebrity bar owning?
God. Like, there are a lot of valid players.
Are the Irish rugby players flogging a little bit too much lip gloss these days? What's going on? Have they forgotten
their eye off the ball? Yeah.
Forgotten about the game?
That's a pretty tepid take.
That's simply what I was left wondering, and I'm hoping maybe
that's some lazy punditry, Ken. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, I know it's a bank holiday. I know, you know, maybe we shouldn't expect your best today, but that's lazy punditry. I'm sorry.
Well, look, it's not my job to make sense of this. I was left baffled. I was left baffled and bewildered by what's going on. I thought Ireland was supposed to be good.
We are. Supposed to be.
So what happened?
It was a ritual humiliation is what it was. It was not very nice to
watch. Ken, you sound like one of the true Irish supporters who Joe Schmidt afterwards pleaded with to stay with the team.
Did he?
Yeah. Shane Horgan didn't like the use of that phrase. He said, I wish the genuine supporters, I hope they stay with us, you know, keep the faith, that kind of stuff. And Shane said, The implication there is if you have a go, you're not necessarily a genuine supporter.
Yeah.
Whereas he feels that even genuine supporters like yourself can.
Well, I mean,
can ask these legitimate
I've just been called lazy by your man over there.
Well, you are kind of in an almost horizontal position on that chair. So you're in serious bank holiday mode here.
Is it lazy to ask questions?
Yeah, well, it's lazy to ask questions about bar owning and Instagram influencing. I mean, literally everything else is on the table. Literally everything else. But that's probably...
Well, we're going to dissect all of this with Jerry Thornley and Matt Williams to answer some of your questions, Ken. This is your one bank holiday podcast today. No football show today, Ken. But while I have you, I'm sure you read with interest that Sunday Times story about John Delaney yesterday writing a personal check to the FAI for €100,000 as a bridging loan.
Been reading a lot of stuff with interest, Owen, starting on Saturday evening when Mark Tighe of the Sunday Times tweeted that he had, the Sunday Times had been successful in terms of there was an attempt by John Delaney to bring a high court injunction to prevent them publishing a story which then appeared in the Sunday Times, but not before the FAI at 11:21 p.m. sent out a statement. Unusual time for the FAI, I have to say, to be sending out a statement. 11:21 p.m. on Saturday night, the day before St. Patrick's Day.
The truth must be heard as early as possible, Ken. And if that's at 11:21 on the night before St. Patrick's Day, well, then that's when it's going to be heard.
So that was as far as the Football Association of Ireland chief executive John Delaney has stated. He provided the FAI with a €100,000 bridging loan in April 2017. The short-term loan was required to aid cash flow on that occasion and was repaid in full to John Delaney by the association in June 2017. The CEO has also confirmed that his UEFA remuneration for 2018 has been donated back to the FAI on a voluntary basis. Speaking tonight, John Delaney said, I'm aware of stories circulating around this loan dating back to 2017. I confirm that I made a once-off bridging loan to the association to aid a very short-term cash flow issue. This is the only occasion on which I provided the association with a short-term loan. That's the end of the statement. There's a few strange things in the statement, really. I mean, number one is, why take out a high court injunction or attempt to prevent this story from being published?
Why not give a statement to the Sunday Times, who had told you they were running this story, and ample time to respond?
Yeah, he'd had more than 2 weeks, I think, and there had been no response until this late attempt to prevent the story, legally prevent the story from coming out. A second statement from the FAI yesterday at 6:13 p.m. expanded on this a little bit. It had more quotes from John Delaney. A lot of them were to do with governance and, you know, he things that he's doing in terms of improving that side of things, driving forward, future-proofing the association. Comments a bit more. He says, I've already commented on the reasons behind the loan.
I acted in the best interests of the association at a time when immediate funding was needed. The loan had no impact on the full financial position or performance of the association for the year. It was a matter of timing. The monies received from Euro 2016 were utilised in that year's budgets, as outlined in the financial report to the 2017 AGM. I mean, there had been, you know, one of the questions that people sort of were saying on Twitter and so on was like, I thought 2016 was a good year financially for the FAI. You know, they'd made a couple of million euros after Euro 2016. They'd made profits. So why in April are they? Do they need a loan from their own chief executive? You know, why? Why do they need John Delaney to write a check, a personal check, for 100 grand to get them over a cash flow issue? It is. On the face of it, quite strange. The money is received from, as CEO, I hold regular meetings with our director of finance regarding the state of our finances, and all items arising are conveyed to our board at monthly meetings. This was the case in 2017 when I acted in good faith for the benefit of the FAI, and will continue to do so. That goes on to sort of promise an April press conference talking about governance and that sort of thing.
Right.
There's another quite interesting story that's appeared. There was another story, I think, in The Sun. Their story was the fact that the FAI have tried to, they receive grants from the government, and they've tried to essentially get the grants paid very early or get them sort of up front. The story that's in the Times today, this is the Ireland edition of the Times by Niamh Lyons and Sean McCarthy, says allegations about FAI handed to politician. A whistleblower has contacted a member of the Oireachtas Committee on Transport, Tourism and Sport with a number of allegations about governance at the FAI. Now, if you remember, this is the committee. We've seen John Delaney.
It'd probably be impossible.
Exactly.
Not exactly be grilled.
Not being grilled on that
everyone
occasion.
That time.
No, being critical would probably be impossible.
He was meant to be in with them, actually, a few weeks back, but that got postponed until April. So he's going to be back. He's going to be in with them. And you can imagine some of these things have come up. But this story in the Times today continues. The individual contacted the politician after revelations that John Delaney, chief executive of the Football Association of Ireland, wrote a personal cheque for €100,000 to his employer in 2017. It is understood the whistleblower is preparing to make a formal complaint to the Office of the Director of Corporate Enforcement. The politician who received the correspondence is set to seek advice from the clerk of the committee about whether the allegations can be shared with other committee members and if the information can be put to representatives of the FAI when they give evidence next month. The correspondence has been seen by the Times, but the identity of the whistleblower has not been disclosed and is known only to the politician. So that's a new story today. I mean, when you see the FAI statement yesterday evening about the reform to governance structures and so on, I guess that's kind of addressing this, the emergence of this new story. So, a lot of stuff is going on here, which I think we're going to talk about in more detail when we do our football tomorrow.
Yep, sounds good. Football podcast on the way in the World Service tomorrow. If you're not already signed up, secondcaptains.com is the place to do it, as you know by now. Right, let's just wish goodbye and good riddance to this year's Six Nations, will we?
Now Fenwick, can he get the pass to JJ Williams? Surely a try for JJ.
Duggan, back to Campbell, back to Duggan. McLaughlin going for that line, and Ireland are in and over.
Well, it's St. Patrick's Day weekend. There's a little festival going on literally outside our window here on Bagot Street. Fiddles are playing. Adults and kids are jogging by on some sort of a fun run. Well, the fun stops right now because it's time to talk about what the hell is going wrong with the Irish rugby team. This autopsy will be carried out by Gerry Thornley. Hi, Gerry.
How you doing?
And Matt Williams. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Alan.
I hope you're both ready for one more Six Nations conversation. Matty Clerkin, a few weeks back, said the most pointless cliche in sport is the one that says you don't become a bad team overnight. It overlooks the fact that you don't need to become a bad team for it all to collapse in a heap. All you need is to become an uncertain team, a worried team, a team that can't do right for doing wrong. Is that what we have in our hands at the moment, Matt, a worried, uncertain team?
Well, you'd have to say that's certainly part of the problem. I think you have a team that's also been deeply analysed by their opposition. Mm. And they haven't developed and moved forward to make that very thorough analysis irrelevant. So in other words, they're doing the same things they did in November. England have picked them. All the other teams have picked them to a degree, with the exception of France and Italy. And they haven't developed to counteract that analysis. And, you know, the great example was from the England game in the first game to the last game, their defence in the 22, off a line-out, they leave Conor Murray on the blind side. And in the first 2 minutes, they chipped over the top. Wales chipped over the top of the beautiful chip from Anscombe because they knew there was no one in behind. And so that's the example of analysis. I think you've also got to say, as wonderful as Joe has been and as brilliant as his staff have been, and they have been and they deserve all the credit, they're a little bit off their game too. They're a little bit out of form. Like the decision to leave the roof open and let the rain in and then not play wet weather rugby has completely bamboozled me, just as the selection of Henshaw. So there's not just one layer to this. There's a number of layers, I think, through the process. And, you know, again, everyone's looking for simple answers, and it's a complex game, and the answers are reasonably complex.
Yeah, Matt, just on that issue about the roof, because I know it was a particular bugbear of yours on the TV coverage. A lot of people have been watching you on TV at the weekend. But just a point that I don't know if you guys got to was, right, the roof was Schmidt decided it's going to stay open. Rob Kearney said that was a decision made in conjunction with some senior players in the team. Whatever way it was made, Schmidt obviously makes the final call there, then plays the way that he played. But how can such a highly skilled Irish team perform so badly? Like, I know you're saying they didn't play wet weather rugby, but it wasn't the most complicated game plan either. Like, these are guys who've grown up in Ireland. They're used to playing in the rain. They've beaten good teams in the rain in the past. What I was surprised was how poor their skill set was compared to Wales in just the most basic tasks.
Certainly no one in our pre-match analysis, everyone that I spoke to and everyone I read thought Wales had the upper hand, but Ireland had a strong opportunity and they would perform. What we didn't or envisage was that Ireland would play so poorly. And Owen, I can't give you a reason why Johnny Sexton, who is a renowned kicker of the ball, we've seen him kick the ball brilliantly for a decade, was almost struggling to get the ball onto his foot. We did a package of his kicks, and we put it on air or on the TV, and about halfway through I started to feel bad because I felt like I was jumping all over Johnny's back. It was just incredible. His kicking game has deserted him. Why do they not, at 10-0 down, knowing Wales give up points so miserly, that's in our very, very shallow analysis for TV compared to the depths that you go in rugby and at the top level, and you get a penalty, you don't take the 3 points. Ireland were given, I forget the exact stat, I haven't got it in front of me now. I think it was 6 penalties in the Welsh half, and they didn't take one shot of penalty goal. Mm. Like, part of that was because the game got away from them. But I can't answer that. I am as dumbfounded as you. Wet weather rugby, and you don't play wet weather. It's a wet day, and you don't play wet weather rugby. Okay, if you think your advantage is to play Wales, to play a running game against Wales, to really move it, then choose to have the roof closed.
My point is that we have executed our skills under pressure in bad weather before. I don't want to get too hung up on this weather thing. Like, we should be able to play a reasonable brand of rugby, even if the weather is not ideal. These guys, most of them have grown up playing in Ireland. They're used to executing their skills with a bit of rain on their backs.
Yes, they are. And so why didn't they? I agree, but they chose to leave the window open, the roof open, and then the window and the door, and then they don't kick the ball into the Welsh 22. They don't have a plan to exit there off the first restart. Man, I'm astounded at it. It just doesn't add up. How can they then come to their line out time? And their maul is stopped. How do they have a scrum 15 metres from the Welsh try line midfield and they get a free kick, which means a bent arm, which is the best attacking platform on the field, by the way. They get a bent arm and CJ Stender takes a quick tap. He doesn't need to take a quick tap. He can just take another scrum because that's the best option for them. There was no need for a quick tap and he doesn't take the quick tap. The ball hits his shin and it's an accidental offside. Like, all those things you're saying, Owen, are means that there is all these strings on the table and none of them are tied up. And I can't give you an answer for it. I'm as astounded as everyone else. But again, the decision-making process from the staff down to the players, if you're saying it's the players on the field, then the execution of the game plan and then taking personal responsibility for your individual performances on the field, all of them have dropped so markedly in such a short period of time that that performance on Saturday was quite shocking to watch for all of us because none of us picked that.
Jerry, when it's that bad, when there's that many individual errors, coaching errors, system errors, psychological errors, do you tend to sort of stand back from things a little bit and go, well, there's one deeper problem here? Or do you start to go into each little detail? Say, I know you watch the games back. Do you start to go into each little error and wonder, where did that come from? Why is that? Is that a tactical thing? Why is Johnny Sexton kicking badly? Why does the back line not look structured anymore? You know, all the little things that go wrong, do you start to look at into each one of those? Or do you have to stand back from the whole thing and wonder what the underlying cause is?
Well, I would say if you stand back and look at it, and you do both, because it was an accumulation of factors. Mm. All the plot lines of that game, from the Democratic decision to have the roof open in wet weather and thereby play a game in wet weather against the best defensive team in Europe was always a risk. Mm-hmm. And once they went 7-0 down and 10-0 down and 13-0 down, Wales never had to play any rugby. Wales created virtually nothing.
Yep. Yep.
All they had to do was defend.
Try, nothing, yep.
And then take their penalties. And Angus Gardner was in a particularly pedantic mood when you think that the advantage penalty from which the first try emanated from, for which Joe Schmidt said afterwards, by the way, that they'd practiced for, so somebody vacated their post, that against James Ryan was as nothing to what Justin Tipperidge did when Ireland went to the corner at 10-0 down and were mauling towards the line and Tipperidge came around from the side and he let them away with it and gave them a turnover scrum. All the momentum moments in that first half went against Ireland, with the possible exception of Tadhg Byrne's turnover and Gareth Davies diving in on a prone Bundiaki, when that would have actually been another 3 points. Mm. So this could have been even worse. I thought initially Ireland's response, the press seats in the Principality Stadium are quite close to the touchline. And I thought the body language and the response initially to going 7-0 down was actually quite good. I really did. Mm. You know, if you think about the next stanzas of the game,
yep.
Ireland go upfield, they get into good positions. Jacob Stockdale.
Brilliant
cross kick from Johnny Sexton. The high point of his match. There was some good response. Unfortunately, Gary Ring was forced to pass, led to another turnover.
But he thought he was on advantage, right?
Yes, he thought he was on advantage. So, like, almost every single momentum moment, as it was, went against Ireland. Mm. And to the point where they were just left with a mountain to climb. And you knew the game was over before halftime. And then, yes, it was very disappointing to see them get very rattled, lose their cool. I thought, you know, the penalty count, like the Keane Healy scrum penalty, when he's actually getting better.
Desperate to get back up again.
Jeepers, come on, slippy conditions. Yeah. That is so pedantic.
But Jerry, don't you
feel...
The
one against Tadhg Furlong, that is so pedantic. It had no material effect in the game whatsoever. I do think Gardner didn't help Ireland at all. Yeah. And all the momentum shift. I agree with Matty. I think at 10-0 down, you might be better off taking 3 points and get on the scoreboard and make it a one-score game. Mm. Remind Wales you're still there. Give the Irish fans something to cheer about. Make Wales kick off for once in the match.
Yep.
But they didn't do that. So they backed themselves consistently to go to corner. It's often worked for them. Teams have negated their line-out maul. Teams have read them now. Yeah. They're seeing the big carriers coming.
Maul's in trouble. It's in big trouble.
Well, it's been badly refereed across the board at the moment. You know, it just really has been badly refereed. But for whatever reason, Ireland are getting very little joy out of that, and they used to get a lot of joy. They did get some joy out of their line-outs against France. I think the underlying thing for me, the biggest concern for me, is that I don't think this was the worst Irish performance ever. I've read that. I think, you know, I covered Irish rugby in the 90s. Believe me, trust me, there are at least, I can think of 20 worse performances than that.
Yep.
It wasn't that bad. And this team has a lot of credit in the bank, as does this coaching staff. They're damaged, for sure. Might be no harm they break up now. But the one thing I want to say, the biggest concern I have, is in the 12 occasions Ireland have trailed at halftime, the Joe Schmidt era, they've lost 11 of them. The only comeback was in Rome in round 3. That's the only time they've come back from halftime to win a match.
That's incredible.
They're a very prescriptive team, Owen, and they're very well coached, and their attention to detail is renowned. And when they get front football, when their line-out is working, when Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton get front football, as we saw for the first hour against France, they're a very smooth-run machine. But when they have to play catch-up, they don't have a halfback combination like Ali Price and Finn Russell, like you saw at Twickenham. Ireland could not do that, could not come back from 31 under. Very few teams could, because you've got real X factor. Finn Russell just told go out and play, and nobody enjoys himself more playing that kind of rugby, and he's quite brilliant at it. I think Ireland are missing a little bit of X factor, you know, the Simon Zeebo kind of thing, that we don't have an awful lot of players with real X factor, broken field runners, who can have good passing, offloading game that can make something happen. It is a little bit prescriptive, and they're going to have to find out ways, as Joe Schmidt admitted afterwards, of getting back and changing things up and getting back into games. But I'd still rather this happen now than next September. And I still believe that Joe Schmidt is entitled to say keep the faith in this team. They've won 21 of their last 24 matches. They're a bunch of very good players. There's a lot of talent there. And I still think they can regroup and get their warm-up matches right and get right for that first game in Scotland in the World Cup. I still have faith in this team.
Yeah, Matty, obviously you still keep faith in Joe Schmidt, but not in Joe Schmidt's current game plan, surely.
Yeah, and Jerry's right. That's stat of not being able to come back at half time.
Polar opposite to England, who can't close out a game sometimes, but anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But it is like, and it's not a stat just over a 6 week period. It's a long stat, and it's a very concerning one. I've been bringing it up for a long, long time that this is a team that their attacking structures are so precise, and their energy levels have to be so high to be successful. And when they are, they're fantastic. You know, if we look back to last November when they beat New Zealand, the precision, the energy, the aggression, the accuracy of their game was quite phenomenal. And if they had have maintained those levels of intensity and energy and aggression, I believe they would have gone a lot better this campaign. So if we split them up into Australian campaign, November campaign, and Six Nations campaign, on top of what Jerry has put into that, which is hugely concerning, it is the lack of energy and aggression that compared to their performances in November is significantly down, in my opinion, especially the England and Wales game. So they're the two big ones for us, the England and Wales game. You know, we said I was wrong. I said whoever won the opening game against England and Ireland, I thought would win it, and then it would come down to the match in Cardiff. Now, if we say the England game and the Wales game, the guys, the energy that just wasn't there. I agree with Jerry. They came back and fought when Stockdale made his break, but for long periods after that, they looked beaten. They were frustrated. Their line speed in defence was poor. Compare that to the Welsh, who were howling up, even in the last seconds of that game. Even in the last seconds, when the game was won, Ireland are smashing on their line, Wales kick downfield, and the ball lands over halfway. And then at the halfway mark, there is a full red line. They've sprinted as a team 50 metres. Now, Ireland were just not doing that. So on a whole lot of fronts, there's a lot of concern. Because if you come back again, and then we come back to Jerry's point, even if you want to put in a new type of attacking structure, it's very hard to do, even in this time frame. Now, I know there's 6 months literally to the World Cup. I think it was yesterday, 6 months to the World Cup starts. But they're away for a long time. They don't come back together until June. What are they going to do? Put in an offloading game then? I really doubt it. Sure, I really doubt
sure,
that that's
but Matt,
possible.
Do you remember we had the conversation around 2015, and you know we talked about Six Nations success and all that kind of stuff, and you said that has to be balanced against what you produce in a World Cup. I mean, there's a big straw that I'm clutching at here, but Schmidt alluded to it afterwards that he got no praise for being knocked out in the quarterfinals. Is there a chance that actually the game plan you're talking about is being worked on, has been worked on, and will start to be unveiled in the warm-up games for the World Cup, and that they have kept that hasn't actually been used at all during this competition?
It's a very small straw, Owen, you're clutching at there.
Gotta do something.
Mate, look, I really want the team to do well. Let's put this in perspective. I believe this is still the basis of an excellent side. And I would disagree with your quote on Malachy. People lose teams can lose confidence, form can desert you for whatever reason, but there's still the core of a very good side there. The pluses, we've used 36 players. That's a real bonus going into a World Cup. remembering, you know, Stephen Donald from New Zealand was the number four, 10 that kicked the winning goal in the World Cup final. That is a real bonus going forward. What is not good is our best players, our world player of the year, and our best players have seemed, form has seemed to desert them for varying reasons. That is very concerning. Second part is what we have been great at, which is our set plays, have been poor. Our line out was particularly poor the other day, and has wobbled since Italy, really. And once or twice against England, Rory Best throws have been not on. Now, Dev Tone has to come back in there, and he becomes very important to us. But I cannot see, in the short period of time, a brand new attacking structure being thrown into that team. I just doesn't happen. The only thing you can see, and they desperately need, is a short kicking game and an attacking kicking game a la Owen Farrell, as England have kicked exceptionally well in this championship. And we're capable of that. Johnny Sexton is capable of that. That's the one thing that, they could add, and we certainly have not seen it. So
We saw it against France, actually. When they were getting a lot of front football in dry conditions, we saw them move the ball across the line, and Gary Ringrose then had space to kick in behind. Keith Earls did it once, Gary Ringrose did it twice, Jordan Larmour did it once. It was quite a variety in the kicking game against France, which we hadn't seen up to before. And you're right, Matt, this has been a real feature of the whole Six Nations tournament, and it was England who came startling out of the blocks with this kicking game. I think they got, what was their stat, Simon? They got 6 of 7 tries directly from kicks and from 6 different kickers, because they're moving the point of attack. And you're right, there's so little space in the modern game now, particularly with a really well-organised defence like Wales, that, you know, more often than not now, the space is to be found with the boot, not with the hand. And it was very instructive to see Jack Cardy come on. I know the game was long since up, but he put in that lovely little diagonal kick for Jacob Stottdale, who did brilliantly in the left wing, and ultimately led to the consolation try, and at least avoided the ignominy of a first scoreless outing by Ireland since 2012 in the Hamilton Horan Show. And you know, I think that could be out of the game. You know, I think Johnny Sexton and Gary Ringrose and other players are capable of doing that. There can be a little bit more of a kicking game when we saw it against France. I'm surprised in wet weather against the blitz defence they probably didn't try it some more. And like I said, it was very interesting when Jack Cardy came on. And just on that one of the more disappointing aspects of the day for me was that it was 22-0 after 54 minutes. It was long since game over. The goose had long since been cooked. It was in danger of getting burnt. It was all over for Ireland. And Joe has talked about exposing players to the white-hot intensity of Test match rugby at Six Nations level. That 55th minute was the cue to bring on Kieran Marmion, Jack Carty, Jordan Larmour, and let's see them perform for 25 minutes under that kind of pressure. Yeah. Instead, they came on after 65, 70 and 73 minutes. And would have just been... I mean, I understand where Joe's coming from in his loyalty to Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton. They are outstanding world-class players. Conor Murray has, up until this Six Nations, been the best scrum half of the world for the last 4 or 5 years. He's regularly outshone Aaron Smith for both the Lions and Ireland in games against the All Blacks. And I can understand he wants them. I think it betrays a sign of concern in Joe that he could see Johnny's performance particularly. This was so untypical of Sexton that he wanted somehow to see if they could miraculously rediscover their form in the last 25 minutes of the game before giving up on them. But he would have been it would have been a better investment to see Marmion and Carty and Larmour in those last 25 minutes. But I do think we could add a little bit more to our kicking game. I don't know, a little bit more offloading. I don't think Ireland need a brand new attacking structure.
No.
I don't think
that definitely
need
wouldn't work anyway.
No, it wouldn't work. And the lineout being particularly poor is not a surprise when you think that 4 different players have called the lineouts. I think Ireland have played 7 different locks, certainly 6 different locks in 5 games.
Matt, you wanted to come in there?
Yeah. Look, I think Jerry's right. Only thing I'd say, the backfield organisation of France against Ireland was absolutely diabolical. You could have left the brass band behind their defensive line. They had no one covering at all. In the first seconds of that game, there's no one covering it at all. Now, I'm not taking anything away from the King game. We certainly, Shane Horgan was jumping up and down with joy to see the outside centres, a la Brian O'Driscoll, when kicking the ball long in that channel, which is what Brian did a lot. Gary Ringrose did it really well. I think the other point there, and again, you know, it's where coaches can, and you just lose a little bit of that faith and that confidence. Against England, I felt the bench wasn't used fast enough, and I agree with Jerry. Against Wales, the bench wasn't used fast enough. If we go back pre-tournament, for the Leinster team, Sexton didn't play, Henshaw didn't play. Now, they were injured, but there's a lot of talk that they were ready to play that last Toulouse game. There was a lot of talk around the traps. They were ready to play that last Toulouse game, and they were held back. So there's, even while our management is great, there is also players need to play. And just coming into that Six Nations with Henshaw and Sexton, not and Toner not having a lot of rugby in that period of time, and Carney, it's certainly came home to roost in the Six Nations here. So we've got a whole lot of issues, and this is the problem. Last year we were winning games, and we were just winning them, but we're winning them. So the margins are so fine here, guys. Like it's 5%, 2%, 1%, and this year we're out of touch, and we still won three. But they're losing the big games. And that's all it takes. That's all it takes at this top level. Now, they've got to find a way to find those 2%, 3%, 5%. Because at the quarterfinals, forget the pool stages. You've got Scotland and all that. Let's not worry about that.
Sorry, Matty, on that.
I'm worried about them.
Stop. No, listen. You're not understanding. You can come second. Lose to Scotland. Doesn't matter. You come second. Still get out of the pool.
Meet the
There's
All Blacks.
Going to be a time in a quarter or a semi you're behind. That's the worry. Even if you lose to Scotland, doesn't matter. You're still going to get out of that pool. Mightn't be in the stage you want. But at a win, a quarter final and a semi final, which they haven't done, there's a strong chance you've got to come from behind. Like Australia did against Ireland in 91. You go through all the teams as they come through. Forget New Zealand. Any team that's won it besides New Zealand at some point has had to come from behind. And Ireland are going to have to find a way to do that. Now, we can argue what it is. That's not our job. That's Joe's job. He knows his team better than all of us. But they got to find a way to come from behind if they got any hope to going forward than we've done in the past.
Matt, just one quick one. I know you have to get on there. But apparently, I think it was the 42.ie printed the team on the Wednesday and, a day in advance or whatever, the team got leaked out. And Schmidt references afterwards. It's one of the things which is frustrating for us is that Gats knows our team before time. It did help with his preparations. That's always a frustration for us. At the same time, these two teams know each other so well. It's like sibling rivalry. And it'll be a bit like that with Scotland at the World Cup. But again, the players know each other so well, so when you know who's going to be where, it is a real advantage. Now, do you think he has a legitimate gripe here, or does it just sound like one excuse too many after another poor performance?
Oh, look, I think if you were missing Sexton and playing someone else in that, be it Cardi or Joey, I think that then it's absolutely major. But, like, we all had that team pretty much picked, except for, Ty Byrne coming in the second row. Maybe that was a little bit up. Like, was there any real high balls there?
Sean O'Brien was the other one who, there were intimations that he wouldn't be around, but then he was.
Well, we all thought, I thought Sean O'Brien would play. Mm. I wasn't surprised with that at all, because when we saw Josh come off the other week, I didn't think it was something he could come back from in a short period of time. So I wasn't surprised with that team at all. No, I thought I can understand that as a coach, and you like to control it. And if there's a big name missing, a big key player, yes, but I don't think that had any influence on the game whatsoever.
Matty, doesn't it surely damage the perception of the management team when they bring things like this up after being absolutely hammered? I mean, these are fine details, whether you hear about a flanker a couple of days before a game or 2 days before a game, as opposed to just getting hammered out the gate by Wales. And they did the same against Scotland, talking about the bus arriving late. Surely you keep quiet, even if it's in your head, that it might have impacted your performance.
Yep. Look, mate, and I'm not going to throw a stone there. Like, I've made heaps of mistakes because you're emotive and you're disappointed and you do all the work and all the planning and sometimes they fall apart. And, I agree with Jerry, the referee was very unkind. But again, I don't think any of those factors we could use as an excuse for that performance that day. A penalty late in a game that gives the opposition 3 points, you lose 16-17, yeah, sure. But I don't think any of those factors had any influence on that game whatsoever. And if I was in a quiet room with Joe, you'd say, listen, mate, next time, don't say it, even though it's true, even though you're feeling it. Just say, Wales were great, we didn't have a good day. And you're going to cop a whole lot of kicks in the head and kicks in the shin. Just wear them and get on to the next one. Because you can't talk your way out of that. That sort of performance, you can't talk your way out of.
Okay. Listen, Matt, brilliant stuff. Thanks a million.
Pleasure, guys. Lovely to talk to you.
What do you make of that side of things, Jerry?
This has been the biggest bugbearer of Joe Schmidt's tenure with the media in his 6 years. It annoys him intensely. And former players have told it. And he's shown his frustrations with us before. I've occasionally got the team forecast on the morning of the Thursday morning, whatever, and he gets very frustrated by it, and he doesn't accept that, you know, players talk, you know what I mean? Mm. Words leaks out, you know, just the way it is. I agree with Matt, he probably shouldn't have said it at the time. He said it in the context of being asked a question about the World Cup and how this would affect the preparations for the World Cup, and he brought this up. I think Wales were on a down day last Wednesday as well, so I doubt really that, you know, the Atari management sat around the 42.ie, took down the team, hauled the players in and said, look, now we have to do this, that and the other instead. Yeah.
You don't completely trust a journalist team anyway.
No, exactly.
As an opposition coach.
No.
Do you think it's more about a sense of a loss of control?
Completely.
Himself.
Like he loves control. He loves controlling everything.
Which makes the roof thing more baffling, because letting the rain in is loss of control,
yeah,
surely.
Yeah, that's what he that was a democratic decision, as far as I understand it. Quite a lot of players and coaches were involved in that decision. I know you say he had the final say, but that was, I think they were just very peeved 2 years ago that when they agreed to have the roof closed, Wales sprinkled the pitch very heavily for about half an hour before
kick-off. Who cares about that, though?
I think they were just still aggrieved by that. That's, again, another thing, like, you know, that gets them. Whatever. Look, it's done. The roof was open. Yeah, it shouldn't have been open. You know, really, it should be. I agree with Warren Gatland totally. It's their roof. They should be allowed to do what they want. Mm. Effectively, it's the away team's decision.
Yeah, well, the problem, the other issue with the roof.
Hopefully, by 2 years' time, that will be the case.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, you've offered another explanation there as to maybe why they kept it open. But the idea that by opening it up, that amazing atmosphere will completely dissipate is not the case either. Many of us have been to Cardiff for games, and when it's closed, it is amazing. Like, yep. I mean, even the Argentina World Cup game, which is at a pretty early time of the day, the pre-match atmosphere, I couldn't get over how good it was with the roof closed. Mm. So, yes, but I've seen a lot of people saying that was still the best atmosphere they've ever seen in a rugby match at the weekend just gone, Jerry, with the roof open. So you're never going to the only way to negate that Wales atmosphere is to stop them scoring early points.
The roof. Yeah, well, look, I would safely say Joe Schmidt hates that stadium. When you think of that World Cup quarterfinal memory and 3 Six Nations defeats there, it would not be his favourite stadium in the world. Let's put it that way.
That's a good point.
And also, just one last thing.
Yeah.
When Joe came out and said that, we've got to cut him a little bit of slack. As Matt Williams said, a lot of coaches, Kevin Keegan, you think back famously in the past, a lot of managers come out in the immediate aftermath of the defeat. They're feeling very raw and they say something that 24 hours later they might not say. Mm. Joe Schmidt is in an
unusual... But it's a bit of a theme with him. I'm talking about the bus arriving late to Murrayfield.
Yes,
He always talks about a ref's decision.
He talks about the ref's decision.
He's not a great loser. Like, who cares in the general scheme of things that he's a bad loser?
No.
I just think it does damage the perception of the job the management team are doing. And it's for all he tries to close out the media and shut down knowledge about the team, this is actually a window into how they think, I think, when they gripe about little things like that.
Yes.
That's more of a window into their mind than,
What do you mean by that?
Because it shows that, like, that loss of control, that sort of obsession over loss of control with little things like the team being leaked by one online newspaper. You know, the idea that Gatland would change his game plan completely. A man who hasn't changed his game plan over the course of those 3 Grand Slams he's won. You know, and I know he then says that's not the reason we lost. But when you get beaten that badly, don't mention little tiny things like that. Mm. It looks really bad, I think. And it is a theme. He comes up with something
small. There was the bug as well. Some of the players had a bug.
That's
which obviously isn't
potentially
ideal.
Bigger reason.
I'd like to get to the bottom of that.
But I just think we should cut him some slack. And the one thing I would say about him now, Joe Schmidt has never been in this position before. He's had a remarkable coaching career. When you think of Claremont, when you think of 4 trophies in 3 years with Leinster, when you think of 3 Six Nations titles, including a Grand Slam, we have never had an era like this.
No.
And it's the most competitive era of all time. And we've never known an era like this for Irish rugby. Throw in a series win in Australia, the first in 79, a first ever away win over South Africa, 2 wins over the All Blacks. Mm. Never having done in history.
I think it's worth rolling out those.
It really is. Yeah, yeah. But the point I'm making is that now Joe Schmidt is copping a lot of flack for the first time ever, and a little bit has been hysterical, over the top.
Well, the second time ever, there was a lot after the World Cup exit as well.
not to this level last year, I don't think. I think people understood that they were missing a suspended Sean O'Brien, an injured Johnny Sexton, Paul O'Connell, Jared Payne.
There was a lot about the game plan, though. A lot about our game plan being too limited.
Maybe.
We did get back into that game, by the way.
Yes.
That Argentina game was completely different.
Yeah, we played great catch-up rugby that day with the second choice.
No, but I take your point. This is certainly the lowest point for the team.
The point I'm trying to make is the lowest point for him, and I hope he doesn't get affected by it. Because it's in Joe, we still have to trust. He still is a great coach. He still is like Brian O'Driscoll, Jamie Hayes, and a bunch of former players would all say this is the greatest coach they've ever had.
Yeah.
Owen Redden said it in this program, the best coach he's ever had last week. And we shouldn't. I hope he.
Shane Horgan, I think, says the same thing.
Yeah. Loads of them do, and I just hope that he stays calm now under pressure, and Andy Farrell does, and the rest of the coaching ticket, and the team leaders, and you know, and ignores some of the hysterical reaction, like this is the worst Irish performance ever. You know, I hope he doesn't get rattled by this. You know, I just hope that he stays composed and calm. I think it might be no harm that they're now breaking up for a few months.
Yeah.
I really do. I think probably it's just as well. They can either park that and forget it, or they can try and stew some of the post-match, you know, Wales celebrations and use that the way England did a year ago at Twickenham when it was a great St. Patrick's Day coronation. And two positive is at least, is aside from all the players being used, is that it's better to happen now and not in September, because then there would have been nothing they could have done about it. And B, they go back to very good provincial setups. Welsh players don't. Welsh players go back to bad provincial setups. They come into a brilliant international setup.
I'm starting to think that's positive for them.
Maybe,
somehow.
But I think now it's a positive for these players.
Yeah.
That Johnny Sexton goes back to Stuart Lancaster. You know what I mean? All the Leinster players do. That the Ulster players go back to Dan McFarland. The Connacht players go back to Andy Friend. And the Munster players go back to a really good coaching staff headed by Johan van Grand there and Razzy Erasmus before him. The RFU have invested heavily in high-quality coaches at provincial level, which the Welsh didn't do. And their regional game is in rag order. And Ireland are at least going back to, like, you remember 2007 World Cup, huge hangover. What happened at the end of that season? Munster won the European Cup. So I genuinely would say this is not fixed. This is very fixable. And Ireland can come back and still have a good World Cup. I firmly believe that.
Eddie Jones has said they're going to look for outside help because they think they have issues with closing games out, essentially, as you touched on.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a chance, A, and do you think, B, Joe should look for outside help?
That is something that he can really think about now. Think about a lot and maybe discuss it over with the other members of the coaching staff and one or two of the team leaders.
A Graham Henry type or
something.
Is that what outside help is? Like a consultant figure? Is that what we're talking about?
At this
about?
Stage, it would have to be just a consultant for
well,
a few
like
months.
England have really benefited from bringing in Scott Wisemantle last May as an attacking coach. Their attacking game has been revolutionised. They played the best attacking rugby in this tournament by a distance.
Way
better than Wales. And if they learn to close out matches, I mean, I can still see why England are higher in the betting than Wales for the World Cup.
Completely.
Absolutely. Yeah. I cannot understand how Ireland currently are higher than Wales in the betting for the World Cup. Wales at circa 8 or 10 to 1 are far better value than Ireland, or drifting down to about 6 to 1 as things stand at the moment. But I'd certainly think Ireland can regroup and go. And yes, maybe they should bring in some outside help. They can think about that. But I would say that every World Cup, nearly without exception, has been won by settled coaching tickets who've been there for 4 years, by and large, you know? So,
What do you think, Malik Kirkman's point, and Owen, I think you read this as well today, that Joe might be a little bit burnt out and that the reason he's leaving is because of that, and that he sensed it in himself. Somebody that obsessive, that thinks about the game constantly, actually just can't sustain that, and actually we're seeing the fruits of it now.
Interesting little comment there. He was praising Warren Gatland for being 12 years in the job. He's been 6 years in the job and it's nearly killed him.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a throwaway remark, again, taken in the context of immediately aftermath of a defeat. Look, it hasn't done Warren Gatland any harm. It hasn't done Wales any harm that they know he's leaving and he's managed to stay there 12 years.
No, it's not the leaving bit.
I just can't believe for a second that Joe won't come back extra motivated to make sure that Ireland have a good World Cup by this Six Nations experience. No, that's not a factor for me.
What do you make of the Scots?
Brilliant.
Loved it. Loved
it. Absolutely loved it. I've said in this show before, Finn Russell is now my favourite rugby player in the world. Yeah, I've been for a while.
I was just gave a mea culpa at the start of the show saying I was talking about how useless he was during when Scotland were underperforming the first half. I looked pretty stupid by full time.
Well, no, that's what he does. You know, he give you 4 out of 10 in the first half and 11 out of 10 in the second. He's well capable of doing this in one match. But it was interesting when he spoke after the game that he said himself and Gregor Townsend had words or whatever. Very interesting that he's now confident enough in his own skin, maybe resulting from that move to Racing, that he can go to Gregor, his mentor. You know, this is a mentor-protege relationship, very much like Joe and Johnny. This is, there's Gregor and Finn. Finn plays a lot like Gregor in the same position, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And he encourages Finn and he stayed loyal to him when lots of others were doubting, and he's being rewarded for that. And it was just wonderful, brilliant, off the cuff rugby, and I would have loved to have seen them win. I think it would have been great for the Six Nations, get that monkey off their back of never having won since 1983. I think they, I've always said it, I think they're a really, really dangerous side in a one-off game like that World Cup.
And that, yeah, I don't agree with Maddie. I think you agree with me, yeah, Jerry, that that's now a danger game.
Oh, really, no, no, Maddie did clarify that. He wasn't saying the Scotland wasn't, he was saying that even if you lose to Scotland, you're still in a quarter final. His point was, once you get to a quarter final, you're going to have to,
Japan are going to be almost as difficult as Scotland.
Yeah, and it's a 6-day turnaround. So, and you don't want to be going into a Japan game having just lost to Scotland. Jeepers.
No.
Not the mental fragility of the team as we saw in the second half in Cardiff.
On you that note, that. On that negative note, we might as well leave negative enough. Just, Six Nations.
Italy didn't win as well. You know, for Conor O'Shea, I think they left 24 points behind.
Well, they butchered that last try at the end.
Yeah, they were so unlucky with the Tomas Allen grubber through that hits off the post. When it's not your day, it's not your day. And France deserved to get beaten there. France has been abysmal. So I think, as bad as Ireland are, France are in a worse place, certainly. They need a new coaching ticket. But it's been an interesting Six Nations, saved in large part by Wales beating England in round three. And good luck to them. We got to finish on that note. You don't win accidental Grand Slams. And this was a Six Nations with the teams ranked second, third and fourth in the world. And they won a Grand Slam. Down on a rock solid defence, brilliantly coached, some world class players, Alan Wynne-Jones, player of the tournament, game plans carried out, and you know, not only good front runners as they showed again last Saturday, but you know, they came back from 16-0 down in their opening game, so they're a good come from behind team as well. And good luck to them, they're a great rugby nation. Hats off to them. And hats off to Warren Gatland. Three, by God, that decision to let him go looks more and more stupid with every passing year, but good luck to him as well. Three Grand Slams and 10 goes at it with Wales. Players from the Scarlets, the Ospreys, the Dragons and Cardiff Blues. Phenomenal.
Yeah, we'll take them in a World Cup semi-final, don't worry about it. Thanks very much, Jerry.
Cheers. Cheers.
First of all, I'd like to welcome John Delaney here today.
Trying to be critical is well being possible.
Building a house, you build the foundations first. The chimney is the top. The chimney for us, it's international football.
As well to John Delaney,
The pleasure, the entertainment, the organisation, the skills that you take to everybody is fantastic.
But you don't have a chimney unless you've got a very strong foundations.
Johnny Sexton has the bat phone to the referee. Murphy, you seem to know what quote I'm talking about there. Who said that?
It's Edward Jones.
Edward Jones, Esquire.
Head coach of the English rugby team.
That's what Eddie Jones... Ken is smiling kind of almost wistfully at the mention of Eddie Jones at the Six Nations launch, right? Now, that may be true. Maybe Johnny Sexton does have a bat phone to the referee. Unfortunately, he uses that phone to give out to the ref most of the time, so it's probably a mixed blessing. But what communication system, I ask, does Owen Farrell have with the authorities?
It seems to be a Jedi mind trick.
It's unbelievable. What's the story with this guy? There's one set of rules for Owen Farrell and a completely different set of rules to everybody else in rugby. He is allowed to use his body as a human projectile with no regard to the safety of himself and his opponents. You're laughing. This is what he does. No regard for his own safety or the safety of his opponents. And all he gets at most... Oh, I'm getting worked up about this. It's a penalty against him. Right, South Africa in November. Do you remember that one? Wasn't even penalised.
What you say, using his body as a human projectile and the worst that happens is a penalty. I mean, that's just a description of rugby.
You wrap your arms, you make attempts to tackle, you don't just throw your shoulder into a man's face as he did yesterday.
You can get a penalty even against you.
Against South Africa, he wasn't even penalised for his so-called tackle on Andre Esterhazen. He got away with another one against Australia, which I'd totally forgotten about until this morning. That was right under his own posts. A clear penalty try and yellow card, but neither. And on Saturday, he looked directly at Darcy Graham, slammed his shoulder into his face and got away with no yellow card because, according to the referee, he was trying to avoid being hurt himself. He was trying to protect himself. Well, there's one good way of protecting yourself, Owen Farrell. Don't go around committing these insane tackles all the time. Look, I'm just grumpy because the Six Nations was so bad for us. But it is true. Farrell,
I kind of feel like somebody should play the bed now, though. It's a pretty good take.
That's a solid take. Now, come on.
But I have seen...
I'm not the only one making it. I mean, a lot of people are making it over the last... What?
More than rectangle.
What you want to do with that, right? You want to put a banging donk on it?
I...
Ken, not over the donk.
Yeah, that's sick.
That is quite a donk.
I have seen...
Do I know what a donk actually is? Not particularly.
I've seen people suggesting that actually this is good because...
Owen Farrell going around smashing lads in the head?
No, Ireland making such a sorry mess of the Six Nations because it would help to ground them before the assault on the World Cup. No?
Bollocks. Yeah, that it has been said, yes, quite a bit.
Because whenever, you know, we do well in the Six Nations, then we do badly in the World Cup. Although we just do badly in the World Cup the whole time.
We do badly at the quarter. Yeah, we get knocked out at the quarterfinals.
We've failed at the quarterfinal stage in any way that you'd like to choose. There are many options to fail at the World Cup quarterfinal, and we have done them all.
Look, we're finished. We're finished the rugby chat for now. That's that Six Nations finished with. Murph, last word to you. You were at Croke Park yesterday for the great GA tradition of St. Patrick's Day.
The club finals on. The club finals. Two goalie teams in. I decided, yes, I should go. I had hopes were high for the Galway double. Thomas's were terrible, unfortunately, in the club final. And Ballyhale had one of those days where literally everything that all of their players hit went over the bar. So congratulations to Ballyhale and their manager, Henry Shefflin.
He's a manager now.
Yeah, kind of felt like last 2 minutes. I mean, they'd made all their subs, but I mean, last 2 minutes, he should have just unzipped the bonnish door bib and just be like, yeah, I'm going in. I don't care. I actually don't care.
When you're the king, you can send yourself on.
I mean, his nickname is the king, but I'm sure he's the actual king of Ballyhale. I mean,
it's an official title. Yeah.
Anyway, the football final had all the ingredients to be like a classic because Crokes have been brilliant all year. I mean, we speak to Mike Quirk on this show quite a bit. His Cairns O'Rahilly team beat them in a game where there was a backdoor element to it in the Kerry Championship. And this was seen as, you know, wow, this is a huge moment in Kerry club football. Like, I've played against a couple of Kerry club football teams. They are unbelievably good. Like, they're sensationally brilliant in every way. And Dr. Crokes run through this club championship like, you know, it's no problem. So they avenged that defeat to Cairns O'Rahilly, won the Kerry County Final, pulling up. So there was a real expectation that them and last year's champions, Carrafane, would give us a brilliant game. It was brilliant. The football being played in the first 25 minutes was brilliant. Unfortunately, from a spectator's point of view, it was all by Carrafane.
Oh, they were so good. The goal they got.
Oh, my God.
With all the hand passes, which, again, would have been ruled out under the
Yeah, I mean, they did this last year to Nemo Rangers. Like, embarrassed Nemo Rangers on Ireland Club Final Day. And then they go and do it to Dr. Crokes of Killarney. I mean, you know, whatever, but, you know, if this was Mullinocte that they were playing in the club final, you could say, well, they were overawed or whatever. But, I mean, Carrafane are just sensationally good. Like, they are. I was watching Joe Brawley last night, and he said it perfectly. I mean, just thank goodness for Carrafane. Like, when you're watching it, you're just saying, God, Gaelic football is actually a really, really good sport. When it's played like this, with vision, with ambition, the whole lot. I mean, like, even just from a Galway club point of view, I mean, I think it's six county finals, county championships in a row now. They're going for Tuam Stairs' record of 8 in a row. Like, we can't even hate them. They're that good.
Yeah.
They're just so brilliant. Like, there are teams that go and dominate and brutalise other teams and they win county titles after county titles and, you know, there's like a festering hatred for them. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but watching Carrafane, it's like, how could you hate these guys?
I saw
a
certain John Murphy saying, Carrafane are awesome. Can't be easy for Kevin Walsh to watch this knowing he's going to have to magically erase this exciting brand of football from the collective minds of Galway fans.
I mean, that's my brother, dear listener. And he is right. I mean, it's embarrassing at this stage that Carrafane could be this good, but also this entertaining. But, you know, I think there were a couple of individuals who played so well yesterday that, I mean, Dahi Burke, four-time hurling all-star, won man of the match.
Right.
But, I mean, there are a couple, like Martin Farrer is insanely good, Dylan Wall, Kieran Malloy, Ian Burke. The hope is that Galway will take a bunch of these guys, play six or seven of them, and maybe we'll see a different style of football to what we've seen from Galway. But
that's not going to happen. We'll be back tomorrow when we'll talk more about John Delaney's woes and we'll reflect on Rory McIlroy being back to winning ways, I would imagine. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen.
Thank you, Ken.
Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your bank holiday, if indeed it is a bank holiday where you are.
John Delaney could run anything.
Got involved in a logistics company in Waterford. I was partly involved in a furniture shop that loaned from my dad as well. We leased a pub in Tralee. I had a vending distribution company, a coffee distribution company, and a bakery.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, they never go home, they never go home, those boys.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.